Revelation chapter 21, verses 9 through 27. This is message 8. This section is it's a little longer, but I don't have as many slides. And some of it is, a little bit of it is going to be some review on some of the previous stuff. But there's a lot of interesting subjects here. So we're going to go into subjects like the descent of the New Jerusalem, the Bride of the Lamb, the walls, gates, streets, and features, the dimensions of the city, the fact that there's no temple, and there's no need of the sun. So there came unto me one of the seven angels, which had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues, and he talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like a very precious stone, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Now, it's interesting that we have an angel here who's showing the city, but the same angel had been used to pour out the seven bowls of the seven last plagues. He'd been involved in that whole thing. And so what's interesting about this is this angel obviously had a couple different hats that he wore in glory. And, well, that's the same thing we do. Many a pastor has two or three hats. Many a person in the work of the Lord has two or three hats. And so this angel here, at one point, he was involved in some very dirty work, the kind that nobody likes to do, but it has to get done. Another point, he gets the glorious job of pointing to the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven. And this is often the way it works in pastoral work and in Bible teaching work. You've got to go through some ugly situations to get to some glorious situations. Now, I also want to point out here that there's an order of visitations in the book of Revelation. Because we've mentioned here we got the seven last plagues. Why does it call the seven bowls the seven last plagues? Well, it's obvious they were the seven last plagues. I'll bring up a slide I brought up earlier. So you notice all the lower level, each of the seals goes all the way to the end. If you haven't looked into this, I would encourage you to look into it, whether you're convinced of this or not. I think that there will be some useful information you will glean from it. But you'll see that we've got the seven trumpets. They end at the end, then the seven thunders, and then the seven bowls. The seven bowls are the last group of seven that gets introduced. There's just a very short order of time there. I don't know if it's a few days or a few weeks, but it's not a very long period of time. And I've already mentioned this in the past, but in the pre-wrath rapture system, they have the rapture happening after the sixth seal is opened and before or at the opening of the seventh seal. They got a very narrow window where they do it. So they put the rapture during the tribulation. The church goes through the first six seals, and then she's only delivered from the seventh seal and the trumpets and the bowls and everything that follows. And they'll say, so we go through the tribulation, but we don't go through the wrath of God. And I'm not going to develop this very farther, but if you want to go into it, I do have a video and some teaching on my website on the pre-wrath rapture, and I walk through that whole subject entirely and show where they made their mistakes. Now, this New Jerusalem is going to descend in Revelation 21, 9 through 11. And we see here a few things in this descent. It's the bride, the Lamb's wife. And here, I think this is metonymy, not identity. It's not saying this city is the bride, so we're not looking at an allegorical picture of the bride. It's just saying if you see this city, you're going to see the bride. Let me give you an example. If you're at a parade and the announcer says, now the next float is the homecoming queen and her court. He's not saying that Ford pickup in that ugly trailer is the homecoming queen and her court. He's saying that that truck in that trailer is bringing the homecoming queen and her court. And that's exactly what we got here. This city, when it comes down, this is the city of the bride. Now, not all the bride is in the city at the time. because some of the bride is here on earth, but that city is the city of the bride. It's the city of that the bride is going to be dwelling in for all of eternity. Now, it's not the bride exclusively either. It's the bride preeminently. The preeminent inhabitants of this city are going to be the co-regent and bride of Christ. But all of the redeemed from all of eternity are going to have access to the New Jerusalem. If you'll notice, and we're going to go into this later, so I'm only going to mention it here, but you have between the foundations and the gates, you have 12 apostles and 12 patriarchs. So Israel is represented in this city. Now, it descends out of heaven. So what we're seeing is the third heaven is seen coming through the second heavens and through the first heavens and down to earth. And heaven is going to move to earth. And the Father will dwell here on earth. And I mentioned earlier, there's two conditions for the descent of the New Jerusalem. Before the Father can come down to earth, before New Jerusalem can come to earth, you have to have a redeemed earth, and you have to have a redeemed mankind. Now, sometimes there's a little bit of disagreement on the exact order that this redemption of the earth and the redemption of mankind happens, but there's zero disagreement in the dispensational camp on the fact that this city will not come down until mankind is completely redeemed. You have a redeemed mankind, and you have a redeemed earth. They're going to deal with the details of that a little differently, but that fact there's zero disagreement on. Now, it's also interesting here. It talks about the glory of God. This city is the glory of God. It's lit with God's glory. Now, what's interesting here, it's not lit with light bulbs. It's not lit with street lamps. It's not lit with any kind of artificial light. It's not lit with sunlight. It's lit with the glory of God. It's going to be an amazing city. Now, when you start thinking about what's involved in this, where there is an unlimited God, there is unlimited light. Where there is unlimited light, there is unlimited energy. That's when you start going down that path, that's pretty cool. And where you have unlimited energy, obviously you're going to have a lot of advantages from unlimited energy. Now, the other thing I want to point out here, and we'll touch on this again later, when you have this city lit by the glory of God, we're going to see later on, it says there's no need of the sun. Some people go down the path, there is no sun, but it doesn't say that. It doesn't say there is no sun. It just says there's no need of the sun. The sun's still going to be shining on the rest of the earth. That's where the earth gets its light. But this city is going to be unique. It will be filled with the glory of God. It will be, and once you go down this path, you start thinking of what it means. It will be as bright in your closet as it is on the city street. It will be as bright inside a building as it is outside the building. It's the same everywhere. It's lit fully with the glory of God. You won't have to put your plants in the south window and hope you get enough sunlight. It won't matter where you put your plants. They're going to get the full spectrum of light from the glory of God in this city. You could have a palm tree right in your living room without any windows. It will still grow. So the other thing that we see here, we're talking about jasper stone, clear as crystal. Now, when you come to the stones in the city, in fact, when you come to stones anywhere in the Old Testament too, there's lots of debate over which stones are represented. If you read five books and journal articles on the identity of the stones, you're going to get five different opinions that are differing on at least seven or eight of the points. We don't know for sure exactly what stones these are. The safest way to approach this is just to take the position that we know they're valuable gemstones and that they're going to have various colors. beyond that, there's some of them we have pretty strong beliefs on, and there's some that the scholars are at sea on. A little help here. The ancients, when they categorized stones, they did not have a scientific method for categorizing stones. So it was difficult for them to tell the difference between a diamond and a very light-colored sapphire. They just knew it was light and that it would cut. That when they came to like a ruby or other red gemstones, they had no way to know a technical difference between a bright red ruby and something that's more in the quartz family, bright red but not ruby. There was just no way to know that. So, or for a garnet, that how would they tell the difference between a garnet and a ruby? If it's a clear garnet in a ruby that's not perfectly clear, they would have no way to know. It's just a bright red stone and it's beautiful. So if you bear that in mind, we come to this. God obviously has 12 stones in mind, but I don't think it's absolutely essential for us to know exactly what those stones were if we understand these were probably the 12 most valuable stones in the world. That's what's going to be. And not just valuable for gemstone use, but valuable for scientific and technological use. And that's what we're ultimately going to find in the walls of this city. Now, when it comes to jasper stone, clear as crystal, this is one of the ones where I think we're probably not right when we call this a jasper. Because jasper's not typically clear as crystal. Jasper's, its lightest, most translucent form is like a dark amber color. Jasper's usually in the brownish, yellowish, reddish directions. It's not as anywhere near as translucent as a sapphire or a diamond. So I suspect probably because it's talking about this stone being clear as crystal and that it's being used of God to reflect this glory that's in the city, this is probably talking about a diamond. I'm not going to put a big bet on that, but if I was to make an educated guess on what stone this is, I would say this is likely the diamond. Because diamonds are it's probably the most translucent of all the gemstones, and it's the one that reflects light the brightest and the mostest. So we have also another interesting thing here. In a way, this city, it should be is a picture of what the church should be. We should be like diamonds in that we're not manifesting our own glory to the world. You know, like a jasper stone, it's going to manifest its own glory, which is a beautiful yellow or a beautiful red in various mixtures. When a diamond comes, it's clear. And what it does is it reflects the light that shines into it. And that's really what we should be as believers. We should be reflecting the light and the glory that God has given us, reflecting His glory. So this city is shining and reflecting and refracting the glory of God. And that's where we ought to be. We should be like diamonds. Another interesting thing about diamonds. A handful of carbon and a diamond are identical in their chemical composition. It's just carbon. But you take that handful of carbon and you put it under heat and pressure and you turn it into a diamond. So I want you to think about this. Next time you're in a very painful, stressing situation and you're saying, God, what are you doing to me? I want you to think that God's telling you, oh, I'm just turning you into a diamond, making you into a diamond. Now, let's look at the wall and the gates, verses 12 through 14. It had a great wall and high and had 12 gates, and at the gates were 12 angels and their names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, and on the east 3 gates, the north 3 gates, the south 3 gates, on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Some very interesting things come out when we look at these concepts that are presented here in this passage. First of all, we have a wall great and high. This simply means it's a massive wall. It's thick and it's high. If we take the traditional understanding of the height of the cubit, which is approximately 18 inches, 144 cubits is somewhere around 200 feet high. In other words, this is going to be as high, maybe a little higher, as a 20-story building. Its thickness, when you have a wall that high and you assume a typical thickness for a great wall, we're probably looking at a wall that's going to be somewhere around 30 feet, maybe 40 feet thick. This is going to be a very thick wall. Now, it's interesting that this city, which coming down after the millennium, has a wall around it. And now, typically, walls kept the enemy out. We're going into eternity where there's no enemy to keep out. So what is the purpose of the wall? And why is there angels guarding it? I think this is just a picture. An eternal memorial of the battle we went through and keeping the enemy out of the gates. It's an eternal memorial that we found our defense in the Lord. Now, at the gate, there's 12 angels. This reminds me of the angels that are guarding the tree of life. Here, they're guarding the city with the tree of life. Now, this guard, again, has to be in some way figurative, because at this point in history, there is no unsafe people that are even available to come into the city. There's no fallen angels that are running around loose that can come into the city. So why is it being guarded? Again, I think that this is a figurative guard, which is just a picture of God's guard over the entire universe. He is on guard constantly. Now, they're not going to actually stop anyone from entering, but it's a picture that nothing unclean is ever going to enter. Now, we also read here about names written. Names are written on the foundations, and names are written on the gates. On the gates, I don't know if it's embossed or engraved, but it's definitely written, and it's the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So we have Israel represented in the New Jerusalem. There's three gates on each side. I wouldn't be surprised if we get to the New Jerusalem and find out that the way that the camp was laid out in the wilderness with three tribes on each side, I think we're going to find out that these gates are probably ordered in the same or at least a very similar manner. On the 12 foundations, we find embossed or engraved the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, I'm not a huge number guy. Some of you maybe have delved deeper into the numbers than I have, but I do find that numbers are a fascinating subject in the Bible. 12 is a regular number of fascination. 24 is a regular number of fascination. These are definitely big biblical numbers. God didn't use them randomly. He never chooses numbers randomly. And you got 12 and 12 equals 24. And the number 12 and the number 24 come up over and over again in the revelation of God. But I'm not going to try and delve into that tonight, since numbers are not an area, the teaching on numbers is not an area where I would regard myself as having anything significant. If you love that subject, I would recommend Brother Missler. Now, the testimony of Israel is a major focus in this city. There were, as the 12 Jewish apostles were the foundation for the church, so we see the 12 apostles here as the foundation level for the walls of this city. And as the 12 patriarchs were, so to speak, because a representative of Israel, that was the door that the Lord used for the old covenant to come into the world, which was a foretaste of the new covenant. It pointed to the new covenant. And then they were the door where the new covenant was promised to Israel. It was given to Israel. Israel was the remnant that became the foundation of the church. So here we have the patriarchs on the doors of this city. There might be a lot more typology here. If some of you guys are typology folks, it might be worth your time meditating on this subject. But there's a purpose. There's a reason why the apostles are on the foundation stones, and there's a reason why the patriarchs are on the gates. I don't think it was random on God's part. Now, while New Jerusalem is preeminently the abode of the glorified church, it's not exclusively the habitation of the church. Israel is going to be there. The Old Testament saints are going to be there. The tribulation martyrs are going to be there. The millennium saints after the millennium are going to have access to New Jerusalem. They don't have access to New Jerusalem during the millennium. At least not there's any indication in the Bible that they're going to get access to go, I don't know, take the elevator to heaven or something. But now, the character and calling here, I find some encouragement here when we look at the apostles and the patriarchs memorialized on this city. And let me tell you why I take encouragement here. The 12 patriarchs were not chosen for their exceptional character. I want you to just enter into this thought. They were merely the descendants of Jacob. They were in the right time, in the right place to say yes to the call of God. That's it. That's where almost all of us are. Maybe all of us are there. I just find that God, when he's going forth in the work of God, is not looking around the world for a man of exceptional character, and he's going to use this man. I mean, he does have that in his mind. But when he's picking and choosing men and women to use in the work of God, he is looking for people that are in the right place at the right time when they're willing to say amen and yes, God. He uses average men and average women of average character to do amazing things because they serve an amazing God. He wants to use people who are fully cognizant of the fact that they are a cracked, chipped vessel with no glory of their own. Probably some of you have sat down at times and wondered, God, why are you using me? I look at the basket case I was when I was a young believer. I look at the mistakes I've made when I was a young believer. Sometimes I've thought, what would I do if I met myself when I was 40 years younger? I run into that guy, I'd probably tear him apart, try and kick his backside. He was an obnoxious, proud, arrogant young man. But God is using me today. And I'm sure all of you have your own experience with this, with God. You're using me? This is crazy. This is better than winning the lottery. Now, the 12 apostles also, they were chosen to some degree for high character, but none of them were perfect. They were all far from perfect. And there's encouragement here too. Because even when we find men of exceptional caliber in their character, their morality, their purpose, they're all flawed. And I find encouragement in this. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be exceptional to be used of God. I have to be in the right place at the right time with the heart that says, yes, God. Now, there's also some thoughts here on distinction and unity. Oh, by the way, if the Lord's got the names of these patriarchs and these apostles on this city, especially these patriarchs, if he would be willing to put their name for public view for all of eternity, I think that every one of us can expect to have our name somewhere on this city. Every last one of us. God's not going to forget anybody's labor. Every believer is going to have a memorial somewhere to them about what they did. Even if the only thing they ever did in their life was give a cup of water in the name of a prophet, you won't lose your reward. Anyway, let's go on to the distinction and the unity. What's amazing about this passage is how dispensational it is. There's a relationship in this city between Israel and the church that's absolutely fascinating. They're both in the city, but they're both distinct. And this distinction carries on into eternity. They're all redeemed under the new covenant. They're all saved by the blood of Jesus Christ. They're all saved by the everlasting gospel. But Israel is Israel, and the church is the church. You don't have the foundation with six apostles and six patriarchs and the gates with six apostles and six patriarchs. You got the foundation as the apostles, and you got the gates are the patriarchs. So God doesn't mix the names. He doesn't mix the testimonies. He doesn't mix the dispensations. My feeling here when I'm going through this passage, and I'm really pumped over this, God anticipated the rise of replacement theology, and he said, I'm going to address that in the book of Revelation. In fact, there isn't a false doctrine or a false philosophy or any kind of significant error in the history of the world that God didn't anticipate and address in the Bible. You know your word of God, and you're going to be able to find an answer for every false way, every false ideology, every false doctrine, every false philosophy. They're all answered in a way that only God could do it. Now, and of course, you get talking to these anti-dispensational people and say, oh, you make a distinction between Israel and the church, and now you're going to be taken away from the centrality of Christ and the centrality of the gospel. And my thinking is, dude, you don't understand dispensationalism. And you don't understand what the centrality of Christ means. I have no idea what you're talking about. Christ is central to the salvation and redemption of Israel. He's central to the whole program of Israel. He is what Israel revolves around. He is that olive tree that they're grafted into or taken out of. By the way, the olive tree is not Israel. The olive tree is the messianic testimony of God from the garden all the way to the end of the age. And that messianic testimony existed before Moses was used of God to give the old covenant to Israel. And Israel is uniquely possessive of this tree because they are the line of the Messiah. But the tree that bears them is the work of the Messiah on earth in the messianic testimony that started in the garden. And that way Israel can be broken out of the tree that's uniquely theirs and put into the tree that's uniquely theirs. But it can't be their tree if they are the tree. The fact that it's their tree distinguishes them from the tree. Anyway, and that's why we can be grafted in. We're not grafted into Israel. We're grafted into Israel's Messiah. Man, don't you wish you could just somehow, by the grace of God, just somehow kidnap every anti-dispensationalist on the planet, strap them down, and just put these electrodes on their brain and just zap them with a dose of common sense and dispensationalism. If I could do it, I would. Anyway, we got all the saints from all of history in one city, united under one Redeemer, one new covenant, one gospel, the everlasting gospel. And I'll just say this here before I forget to say it. We come to that concept of the everlasting gospel in the book of Revelation. This is talking about the simplicity of the gospel that's been in the garden since Adam and Eve were clothed with lambskins as a picture of being clothed with the Lamb. And since they received the promise that they're going to be the seed of the woman, that's the first promise of the coming Redeemer. So the testimony of the Old Testament, no matter whether you're in the patriarchs or whether you're in the law, that testimony is revolving around the concept of a Messiah Redeemer. And that everlasting gospel spread from Adam and Eve all the way through all the ages to now. It exploded with light at the first coming of Christ. It's going to explode again with more revelation in the tribulation under Moses and Elijah. Not so much new revelation, but an active, powerful testimony to enforce what's already been given. And then we're going to move into the millennium. But this testimony is all about the Messiah and that everlasting gospel. Nobody has ever been saved in any way throughout the history of the world by anything other than salvation by grace through faith. The law cannot save. The law can condemn. The law can be a schoolmaster to show you your weakness and point you to the Messiah, but the law cannot save. So once in a while, I'll run into a preacher who's fallen like some kind of old school Schofield type teaching, and they're going down this path of men are saved by the law in the tribulation, and it's like, bro, you can't be saved by the law. How could you say that you used to be saved by the law, and now we're in the church age, and you get mad and say, nobody can be saved by the law in the church age. You can be saved by the law back there, and you can be saved by the law in the future, but you can't be saved by the law now. It's like, can we be consistent? I mean, either you can always be saved by the law, or you can never be saved by the law. You can't be flip-flopping like a ping-pong game. Anyway, you can tell it's a hobby horse for me. I love grace. I love salvation by grace through faith, not of works, lest any man should boast. All right, the dimensions of the city, Revelation 21, 15 through 16. He talked with me that had a golden reed to measure the city and its gates and its walls. So the city was laid out as a square. Its length is the same as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length and breadth or height are equal. Now, why in the world would God measure the city? God already knew the dimensions of this city. He didn't need an angel to measure it. He knew it to the billionth of a millimeter. He's very precise, and yet he still sent an angel to measure the city. And he measured it with the actual measuring instrument. So the insight here, this is just another example that God in his dealings with mankind walks in condescension, and he employs second causes in his dealings with mankind. So he's using angels, he's using humans, and he's using a measuring rod. So this is like going to Home Depot and buying a tape measure. He's measuring the city. So here is another nugget to put up here in your thinkle later. And that's this. If we are going to measure the length and width of height of things in eternity, then this implies that we are also going to calculate, estimate, design, and engineer in all of eternity. It implies that. The Bible is full of these little hints of what eternity is going to be like. They're rarely the main thought of the passage, but they're in the passage, and they're there for us to percolate and to think about. I'm perfectly convinced that in eternity, we're going to have the same three jobs we have down here right now on earth. We're not going to cease to be a human being that's a human being. Right now down here on earth, we work, we play, and we worship. In eternity, we're going to work, play, and worship. We're not going to go from work, play, and worship to 24/7, 365 full-time worship. It's not going to happen. If that was our purpose in eternity, why in the world would God make a new Jerusalem? That's the dimensions it is. You would only need less than 1% of that area to pack all the human beings in, like sardines around the throne for 24/7, 365 formal worship. If we're going to be engaged in 24/7, 365 formal worship, every one of us for all of eternity, and that's all we're going to do, 99% of this city is irrelevant. You'll never see it. You'll never walk the streets. You'll never hear people laugh in the streets. You'll never drink coffee in your favorite cafe. But here's another one going beyond that. If 24/7, 365 formal worship is our only job description in eternity, why is there a new heavens and a new earth? God doesn't need it. The angels don't need it. It's made for man's inheritance through Jesus Christ. We already read in Deuteronomy yesterday that the heavens that we see are given to us for an inheritance. And I mean, it's an inheritance enough just to be able to look up there and say, wow, God, you were so amazing. But I don't think that exhausts our inheritance. I fully intend to go walking on Mars barefoot and grilling steaks on Mars in that red dirt. And I'll have a red dirt steakhouse up there. All right, anyway, the dimensions of the city. Now, it's 12,000 furlongs. The furlong is a Roman measurement of 12,000 stadia. The furlong is just the more or less the English equivalent of the Greek stadia. That's an eighth of a Roman mile. So we're looking at 1,500 miles. Now, this raises a question. Does this 1,500 miles pertain per side so that's 1,500 and 1,500 and 1,500 and 1,500? Or is it 1,500 miles for the entire perimeter? Just based on how I've seen dimensions of cities given in my reading in classical and Koine Greek, I would say I think this is the perimeter of the city. It's giving us a city that's 375 miles by 375 miles, which gives us a perimeter of 1,500 miles. The Romans often laid out their forts in squares, and they laid out some of their cities in squares when they engineered a city. The Greeks did the same thing at times. And then we come to the height. Now, if it was laid out as a cube, then every point in the city would be exactly the same height. But if it's laid out like a city is normally laid out, this is saying that the highest buildings in the city, or whether they're 1,500 miles or they're 375 miles. So it's not an article to die on. It's not a hill to dig in and die on. But I'm just giving you my experience in reading Greek, how I would understand this. Now, what's interesting about a few other things, I did mention before, I don't think it's a cube. In my estimation, I think a cube is kind of ugly. I don't, go ahead, bro. You got a point?
Well, I'm just going to push back on
that. Yeah.
Because you think it's ugly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well,
I mean, it's the definition of a cube, and you said here, many cities in ancient times were laid out as squares, none were cubes. Well, of course, none were cubes because this is something different. Like we're in a new dimension in heaven. So, I have no problem with it's a cube. I have no problem with it's that massive.
Yep.
And that we are have new bodies. And so we're not going to be interacting with it on the same way and level that we're interacting with this world now. It's not the same.
Well, I would challenge that thought a little bit myself. And the reason I would do this is when we see the few examples of the resurrection body that we have in the New Testament, we see the Lord Jesus. He's going to appear in a room. He's able to walk through a wall, appear in the room, yet he can sit in a chair. We see the Lord Jesus eating a short lunch with the disciples. So he's interacting with creation, physical creation, the same way that we're interacting right now, with one exception. Right now, we're limited by physical creation. The glorified body is not going to be limited by creation. So we will be able to instantaneously travel, or we'll be able to use a second cause and travel by bike or horseback. We will be able to walk through a wall or sit in a chair because our...
And we could exist in a city that's a cube.
Because it's
going to be completely different.
And I'm not saying... I wouldn't die on this hill, but I would point out that if the Greek had intended to say a cube, they have words they could use for a cube. When it gives the dimensions, if we read about the dimensions of a Catholic cathedral, and it gives us the dimensions, and it would give us the width and the depth and the height, and there are a few cathedrals whose width and depth and height are identical, the height only gives us the height of the highest point on the building. And so when we measure buildings, we measure the height of the highest point. If we're going to measure a city, a collection of buildings, the highest point in the city would be the highest point. My whole thought here is simply that if it's described as a city, I think what he sees looks like a city to him. It doesn't look like a cube. But I could be wrong. This is just my estimation of what I see here. So anyway, the other thing I would like to say here is that this city, in the beauty that's in it, is going to make man's best architectural efforts in history look like children playing with Legos. It's going to be insanely beautiful. Now, let me give you another interesting speculation about the height of this city. Regardless of whether you think it's 375 miles high or whether you think it's 1,500 miles high, regardless of whether you think it's a cube or just the tallest buildings are the representation of the height, you're going to have one advantage here. The top of this city, the high points in the city, are going to be outside Earth's gravitational pull. That means interstellar travel and travel to the inner solar system and to the asteroid belt now takes almost zero energy to engage in. You don't have to have enough. The vast majority of energy for inner space travel is used to get out of the Earth's atmosphere, and the second most is to come back in safely. It doesn't take that much energy to travel through the emptiness of space. So when you leave Earth from the emptiness of space, it goes out and comes back super easy, and then you just use elevators to move things up and down. Anyway, I personally, this is my opinion, I suspect that God actually does intend to extend the dominion mandate to all of creation, the entire universe, that we will travel to galaxies and solar systems and explore and mine and maybe farm and do botany and research. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we get out there and we find out that almost every solar system in every galaxy has at least one planet in the Goldilocks zone, whether it's already filled with flora and fauna or whether it's ready to terraform. So there's something for every individual. And I suspect we're going to go mine the moon and the asteroids. You know, one large asteroid has more platinum group metals and more rare earth minerals than we've ever mined in the entire history of the Earth. It's interesting that it's out there. By the way, I don't know if you're familiar with this. Where did the asteroid belt come from? You look at ancient history, the ancients had six visible planets, not five. We only got five now. There was a planet between Mars and Jupiter where the asteroid belt is now. And in ancient history, around the time of the fall of Troy, two of the gods, that is two of the planets, collided. Now, they didn't physically touch because they're going to bounce off of each other or explode when they hit their Roche limit, which is the electromagnetic attraction between those two bodies and the gravitational attraction. They don't actually touch each other. They're going to bounce off each other. But they came close enough with such impact that one planet exploded and it became the asteroid belt, long-period comets, short-period comets, the satellites that orbit around Jupiter, the satellites that orbit around Saturn. It became the trans-Neptunian objects, and some of the pieces became moons around some of the planets. This is why some of the planets have like round moons and a couple weird-shaped chunk moons. It captured pieces of this. But I think that this is an example of a judgment of God, part of the curse that ends up being a blessing. You got all those asteroids out there already broken up in pieces, ready to be mined for exploration in the future. Just a thought. If you can't swallow that one, that's okay. You can still swallow your coffee. All right, more on the walls, Revelation 21, verses 17 and 20. He measured the wall of the city, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. And the building of the wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of precious stone. There's jasper, sapphire, chalcedony, emerald, onyx, carnelian, chrysolite, beryl, topaz, chrysoprase, jacinth, and amethyst. Some of these were probably right on, some of these we might be close, and some of these we probably have no idea what the right translation is. Now, here we read, according to the measure of a man, that is of an angel. I find this a very fascinating thought. Angels in general, apart from classes like the seraphim, look like human beings. Now, it's maybe another question whether they're natively look like human beings or whether they just normally assume the appearance of a human being, but the Bible often treats them with the language of dealing with the man. Also, the interesting thought here is angelic science and measurements seem to parallel human science and measurements. So they're using the same kind of measurements in heaven that we use on earth. And if you track this line of thought in the Bible, it's fascinating that we read in Genesis about people that invented science and technology and musical instruments, and yet then we go through the scriptures and we see those musical instruments in heaven. Now, I tend to think the way to resolve this is that when we invent stuff, we're not coming up with new thoughts. We're rethinking God's thoughts. We are discovering stuff that he hid in creation for us to discover and capitalize on. Now, maybe your mind never goes down this kind of a path, but once in a while when I'm eating a bowl of ice cream, I often find myself thinking, I wonder what God was thinking the first time a person figured out how to make ice cream out of cow's milk, out of cream. And he's probably thinking, I wondered how long it'd take you guys. Now, it says the building of the wall was jasper. So you've got the foundations are 12 different expensive gemstones. Now, let's just say one of these layers was actually ruby. And maybe one of these colored stones here probably was actually ruby. Ruby is one of the most useful, valuable stones in our universe. But if you had a layer of ruby, let's just say it's a few feet thick and it's, 30 feet wide? And then you've just 1 mile length of the wall and you've got 375 miles on one side, at least, if not 1,500 miles. Just a mile of ruby that's a few feet thick and 30 feet deep. That's more mineral wealth in one chunk of that foundation wall than we've ever had in the entire history of the world. That's more wealth there in that ruby than all the wealth of all the wealthiest men in the history of the world. So God just puts this right on display, displays his amazing wealth and beauty. Now, again, I mentioned that I think jasper's unlikely to be actually the stone that's called jasper here because jasper's the wrong color. It's not translucent enough. It doesn't refract light like the diamond does. I suspect that this is actually talking about a diamond. Now, the one other thing that I want to point out is that when we look at the wealth in this city, and we look at the fact that we're actually sons of God and we're heirs of God, and that we're going to actually go into eternity where this element of servanthood is reduced to the element of sonship is elevated, that we are going to be living in an environment of wealth and prosperity and blessing and royal privilege. No, we read in Galatians, henceforth I'm not calling you servants anymore, but sons. And if sons, then heirs. And what a blessing this is. I think that in circles that get excited about discipleship and serving God, there's always a danger of reducing or suppressing the doctrine of the sonship of the believer. If we enter into sonship, and the way that we should enter into it, it will take us to greater heights of devotion and appreciation than pure servanthood ever could. It's the same thing. Grace can take you to higher heights of devotion and holiness than the law or works or rigorous standards ever could. Every one of the most holy living believers I know, filled with zeal and desire and fire for the work of the Lord, every one of them is on the basis of grace. You try and reach that in circles where they got rules and regulations and standards and whips, people get wore out. They get tired. They lose their fire. They lose their devotion. But when you get anchored to that fire that's in the heart of Jesus Christ for the work of the gospel, for the work of discipleship, for the work of encouraging the believers, for the work of looking forward to the eternity, when people get filled with that, it takes you to degrees of sacrifice, to places of service you could never go any other way. Well, anyway, that's a glorious thought. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each one gate was one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. Now, each gate was one pearl. Now, God could, because he's God, he could just snap his fingers or wave his hand or say whatever he said and make the city with one command and make it the way it's made. But as I go through the scriptures and see how God works with creation, how he works with man, he's often in the realm of second causes. And when he spoke the universe into existence, but virtually everything he's done with man since then has been operating within the realm of nature using the laws of nature. Even what appears to us to be miracles is probably just God using one law of physics to override another law of physics. To us, it looks like a miracle, and to God, it's just A squared plus B squared equals C squared. But anyway, one massive pearl. In my mind, this implies that there are massive planets with massive seas, with massive oysters or massive other creatures that make massive pearls. This kind of hint here is meant to wet our whistle for an amazing, amazing universe. This is talking about something big enough to make a pearl this 200 feet in diameter. Now, let me take a look. I mean, you could do all kinds of stuff with that. You could carve bathtubs and bird feeders and birdhouses out of pearl. But let's take a spiritual application from the pearl. How are pearls formed? Pearls are formed when a grain of sand or some other irritation gets inside the oyster. And there's freshwater mussels make pearls too. So there's other creatures that can make a pearl. But the oyster will deal with this point of irritation by covering it with mother of pearl. And a layer after layer after layer. That's the same stuff that they coat the inside of their shell with. Now, over time, the irritation becomes a point of beauty. And I've often observed with believers that many of us have a point or two of irritation in our life where we're more easily irritated than anywhere else in our life. And over the years of God dealing with us on that point of irritation, that grace gets layered over it and layered over it and layered over it until an area of irritation becomes an area of great beauty. So you could have a brother who's just struggled with anger, just flying off the handle for years, and he has to have a layer of grace and a layer of grace and a layer of grace until he comes to the point where when he's dealing with people, people say, "You are so patient." And you're thinking, "You have no idea where I came from." You have none, because by nature, I was not a pearl. You see a pearl now. This is the grace of God working in my life, fixing a point of irritation. Now, we also read here a pure gold like transparent glass. And I don't know how many commentaries I've read in where people say gold gets its gold color because it's impure, and when we get into eternity, we're going to have pure gold that's clear as glass. Problem is, when you purify gold to 99.49s, pure gold, it's still gold colored. The native color of the gold that appears on earth is gold colored. It's not clear as glass. But this gold here is clear as glass. And this implies that somewhere in our solar system or in our galaxy or somewhere in the universe, gold appears in a form that's different on its subatomic structure than the gold that we have. And that gold is going to be clear as glass. And this has a lot of amazing uses. Could you imagine you coat a windshield with pure gold It protects it from getting chipped and broken. And not only that, but instead of having these four or five ugly lines of black going through your windshield for the defroster, the whole windshield is equally defrosted because it's got a layer of gold on it. Now, the mind that works like mine and is easily goes into imaginations, you could start thinking of all kinds of uses for gold as clear as glass. But once you start going down this path and you think about it, we are serving a God that is a God of great variety. And you look at mankind, you look at nature, you look at the universe, and he has tremendous variety everywhere. I suspect that what we're going to discover is that not only does gold appear in its gold color and translucent like glass, we're going to discover that gold has 100 other shades and colors in the universe. Pure black gold would be useful for solar energy, solve a lot of solar energy problems. But this also implies that there's variations in pearls and there's variations in the gemstones. God just gives us a taste here. No need of the sun in verses 22 and 23. There's no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. Now, there's a difference. On earth, there is a millennial temple, and the earth is pretty clear. I mean, the scriptures are pretty clear that millennial temple in earthly Jerusalem will be on earth for eternity. But the scriptures are also clear that when the new Jerusalem comes down, there's no temple in it. This is the difference between the earthly people of God and the heavenly people of God. Now, the Father and Son are the temple. There's nothing mystical here. We're going to have, the scriptures are clear, we're going to have worship in eternity. There just won't be a formal temple where we gather in and we worship. I think worship could be anywhere in this city. It could be anywhere that God wants the worship to take place. There will be worship, there just isn't a temple. And it's really taking us deeper into the idea that the worship of God is not limited to a particular place. The worship of God is simply recognizing God for who he is, and we can do that no matter where we are. We can do it in a church building, we can do it in the woods, we can do it in a boat, we can do it in a prison cell. Now, the other thing I want to point out here is, and I mentioned this before, we're going to have two jobs in eternity. I don't believe we're going to be 24/7, 365 formal worship. We're going to have regular worship, but the rest of the time we're going to be doing our human work in our human play. We're going to be amazed and wowed by God over and over. Every time we come to the throne for formal worship or come to wherever we're worshiping, we're going to have fresh wow and fresh amazement so that we're always going to have fresh worship. Now, when we come to the sun, it says there's no need of the sun, doesn't say there is no sun. I don't know how many times people have said to me, but brother, there's no sun in the new heavens and new earth. I said, well, where'd you find that? And they read this verse. And I say, okay, where in this verse does it say the new heavens and the new earth have no sun? All it says is the new Jerusalem has no need of the sun. And the new Jerusalem is lit by the glory of God. So when we go on to look at this, we're simply going to see as we go through the scriptures, there are passages, we mentioned some of them earlier, that have the sun and the moon existing for all of eternity. The very fact that there's a new heavens and a new earth implies there's a continual existence of the stars, the sun, and the moon. So this really comes down to the glory of God. That's what lights this city. It doesn't need outside light. Now, here's another interesting thing. There's a little bit of an analogy here. Although God has ordained teachers in the church, and we should make use of them, he's ordained pastors, we should make use of them, right? But you could be in a prison cell in Siberia with nothing but Galatians and John. That's all you've got. And maybe a few pages missing out of them. And you still have the Holy Spirit. you still have access to the glory of God. You don't need outside light coming to you if you have the Word of God and the Holy Spirit. You don't have absolute need of it. Anyway, there's just a little bit of an analogy there. All right, we're getting near the end here. The glory and honor of the nations are going to flow into the city. So the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it. The kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. And its gates shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. Now the nations of them which are saved. There's still going to be distinct nations and countries in the kingdom. There's going to be distinct people groups and distinct languages. And these nations are going to look to Jerusalem because of who's there as the fountain of truth, the fountain of knowledge, the fountain of wisdom. And they're also going to recognize that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And they're going to bring the glories and treasures of the nation, agricultural, industrial, mining, whatever. They bring their treasures to New Jerusalem. In fact, one of the passages we looked at earlier, ships will be bringing them from around the world into the Mediterranean and bring them to Jerusalem. Now, the glory and honor is the whole range of everything that people will trade in, the commodities and minerals and metals and whatever else, artwork, in eternity. And the gates are not going to be shut by day. No, normally gates were open in the morning and shut at night. These gates will not need to be shut. There's no evil that can come in. There's no evil that can defile. And there's no night in this city. It's going to be well lit. Now, I do want to add one thought. This city is going to be the greatest cosmopolitan city in the history of the universe. Nothing will ever compare to it. Every language, every culture, every form of architecture, because it's going to be there. Every culture has its unique language, its unique food, its unique cuisine and clothing and art, their own beauties, and it's all going to be here in this city. One of my most amazing experiences I ever had, I spent a week in Times Square area of New York City when I went to a school learning to trade on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. And that was an amazing week. I'd go into the Starbucks, I'd be number 12 in line, and all the 11 people in front of me, the groups were speaking different languages. It was an amazing time. It was just a smelting pot. New Jerusalem is going to be a smelting pot of all the glories of every redeemed people and culture in the history of the world. And this will be the last slide. Nothing that defiles shall enter Revelation, or shall enter the city, Revelation 21, 27. Neither anything that works abomination or makes a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. This confuses some people. They say, wait a minute, this comes down after the millennium, and it's here on earth, and yet it says here that nothing unclean is going to be allowed to enter. The unsaved are not going to be allowed to enter. So are there still unsaved people on earth? No, there's not. What this is talking about is it's giving us a perspective for looking ahead to this city, and it's saying that this glorious city is going to come down. The ungodly are not going to ever have access to this city. Only the godly are going to have access to this city. So it's not implying that going into eternity, there's still ungodly and godly on earth, and the ungodly get excluded. It's just simply saying, from our perspective now, looking forward to that, the ungodly are not going to have access. They're going to go into the lake of fire. The godly get access to this city. So that's all. I thought it was going to be shorter, and I got long-winded.
All right. Well, let's give Lee a hand.